Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and now we're delighted to have back with us a true genius when it comes to intelligence. And while that may sound redundant, it is definitely not, based on his years of renowned research. Howard Gardner is the Harvard Professor of Cognition and Education, best known for his theory of multiple intelligences, that so much that we should recognize as intelligence can't be measured by an IQ test. I've been thinking about Dr. Gardner ever since that recent study came out indicating firstborn children had higher IQs than their younger sibs. Howard Gardner's latest book came out this spring called Five Minds for the Future from the Harvard Business School Press. Hi, Dr. Gardner. Great to have you back on WNYC.
Hi, good morning, Brian, and to your listeners.
Did you see that study and all the press coverage of the firstborns and their slightly higher IQs?
I did, and certainly as a consumer of literature, I'm interested in this finding because, as all the commentators pointed out, it can't possibly be due to genetics. And the real issue is whether the difference that was documented is one that you would always find in any society or whether it has to do with how closely together kids are born and also with whether parents have enough resources so when number two is born, they can pay as much attention to the child as number one. On the other hand, the difference was 3 points. It wasn't 15 or 30, and three IQ points are, I guess I would say, interesting to statisticians and scientists, but it doesn't really matter much to the rest of the world.
Although the researchers who put out the study and had one of them on the show said that could be the difference between getting into a state school and an Ivy League school. That 3 points. Does that ring false to you?
Yeah, it does. I think that because if you think about three IQ points and you translate it into an SAT, it's going to be a small enough difference that other factors such as the grades in school, the extracurricular activities, how good your essay is, how good your recommendations are, that would dwarf a 10 or 15 SAT point score. So, no, yes. Obviously, the researchers want to justify their work, but I don't take a 3-point difference very seriously.
That's interesting. But it's beside the point of why I thought of you immediately. And the reason was because the media vernacular quickly became that firstborns are a little smarter than their younger sibs. And I thought, well, if the study is accurate, maybe smarter in one way. But I wonder if you have ever studied birth order and multiple intelligences.
Good point. I haven't looked at that explicitly. But your comment suggests to me that one of the things that the later born has to do is to psych out how the world works. Because there's a big sibling around there who's getting a lot of resources and a lot of attention. And often the second born has to define himself or herself in opposition to the firstborn, find a different niche, so to speak, figure out how to get attention. And that would involve what I call the personal intelligences, understanding yourself and understanding other people. So maybe if that study were done, hasn't been done yet, we would find that indeed people who have a better social and emotional awareness tend to be later borns. And if we value that in society, we might want to skew our admissions and our hiring processes in these ways. So, yeah, I've tried to complexify the notion of intelligence, and your question pushes in that direction.
Yeah, and your original theory of multiple intelligences, for people who don't know, includes logical, linguistic, musical, spatial and visual, kinesthetic, intrapersonal, interpersonal, and naturalistic. And I've seen plenty of families where it seems to me that, yeah, maybe the firstborn is a little more cognitive, you know, better suited to IQ tests, but the youngers have better social skills, which might actually put them in better position to succeed in the real world in many cases. Any thoughts about that?
Well, we do know that later borns are much more likely to be rebellious and to challenge the status quo. Almost all the great revolutions, whether they were political, religious, or scientific, have a lot more adherence among later borns than they do among firstborns. So if you're looking for an entrepreneurial, innovative, creative kind of society or business or school, you might well want to skew again toward later borns. But I don't think anybody who's listening to this ought to revise their child-rearing plans because these are all statistical findings across millions and millions of people. When it comes to your own two or three or in my own case four kids, the statistics don't mean much. You should love your kids, help them find something they want to do, and how to try to develop the five minds Times, which I talk about in my more recent book.
Which we will get to in just a minute. And in there you actually do have advice for parents as well as for teachers. But just one thing about the multiple intelligences model that I've never gotten to ask. You have both interpersonal and intrapersonal intelligence as two different categories. What's the difference?
Interpersonal is involved understanding other people, knowing what motivates them, how to work with them, how to get them to do what you want. The Tom Sawyer ability to get somebody else to do the painting for you. Intrapersonal has to do with understanding of yourself, having a good working model of who you are, what you want to achieve, what sorts of things to do that will help you along. And you could have very good interpersonal intelligence without much intrapersonal. I think Ronald Reagan clearly had a lot of interpersonal intelligence. There's no particular evidence that he was very introspective and that he had a deep understanding of himself. And many poets or philosophers or monks might have a lot of intrapersonal intelligence but not particularly be good at motivating people or bringing about a social kind of consequence. So they're not completely divorced from one another, but they're quite different. Also, primates, other than human beings, have a lot of social intelligence, interpersonal intelligence, but there's no evidence that they have any particular introspective intelligence.
Howard Gardner, Harvard Professor of Cognition and Education, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called Five Minds for the Future. And in this book, Dr. Gardner, you lay out a list of different kinds of minds. Is that different from different kinds of intelligences?
Absolutely. Indeed, this is one advantage. If you've never heard of the multiple intelligences, there won't be any interference with my new list. In the book, I stop being a psychologist and I become a policymaker. And I say, if I were in charge of educational systems around the world, and this is not just school but in business and in the community, what are the five faculties which I'd most want to work on? And three of them are chiefly cognitive. They have to do with using the mind in problem-solving kind of way. And two of them have to do with the realm we've just been talking about, the social realm, dealing with other people who live on the planet with us. So should I run through them?
Yeah, let's do it briefly. All five kinds of minds. The first is the disciplinary mind.
Right. The disciplined mind has two meanings. One, learning to work on things regularly so you'll get better at them. And this is, of course, important for anybody who wants to become an expert, which is the second meaning of disciplined. In the future, you have to be very good at something. Otherwise, you won't be able to get a job at all, or you'll be working for somebody else who is good at something. And that's because almost anything which can be done in a routine way will be done by computers. And so you have to have enough discipline, so to speak, to be one step ahead of the computer. The second kind of mind, which is the one I find tremendously fascinating because it's one we're all dealing with today, is the synthesizing mind. The synthesizing mind recognizes that we're all deluged with information on the web, on the internet, books, papers, video, and so on. How do we decide what to pay attention to and what to ignore? And then how do we put it together in a way that will make sense to ourselves? Otherwise, we'll lose it, we'll forget it. And if we have to communicate, as you and I are doing, and as everybody except a hermit has to do, how do you communicate your synthesis to other people? This is so frighteningly important nowadays, and yet my field of psychology has had almost nothing to say about it, so I had to start from scratch in my study of synthesis. Disciplined mind and synthesizing minds, so to speak, give us the box. The box means the kind of stuff we have to deal with every day.
That is being expert in a particular area and then being able to deal across areas.
Absolutely. The third kind of mind is the creating mind. And I talked about having the box. The creative mind is being able to think outside of the box, coming up with new questions, new problems, approaches which nobody has come up with before. And whether it's in business or in the academy or in the professions, more and more the premium is on people who can think about things that the rest of us can't. And, of course, who can think about things that computers haven't been able to think about yet. So the Silicon Valleys, the Hollywoods, the Wall Streets have tremendous rewards for people who can be creative. And one of the reasons people still look up the United States as a place to go to, even if they don't have much use for our current politics, is because we're seen as the great hotbed, the great seeding area for creative minds. So those are ones that I've been working on for many years, so to speak, being disciplined, being able to integrate and synthesize, and being able to think outside the box. But the last two kinds of minds are ones that I really have focused on in the last decade or so. And those are the minds which are going to allow us to live on a single planet without killing one another and have workplaces and communities where we want to live. And I call those the respectful mind and the ethical mind. And the respectful mind has to do with how we deal with one another, particularly with people who don't look like us, who don't sound like us, who may have different mores, different religions, and so on. We can hate these people, we can ignore these people, but that's not possible anymore because it's one world where we're in instant contact with everybody. And so the respectful mind gives other people the benefit of the doubt, tries to understand them, tries to get their perspective, tries to work with them. And actually studying the respectful mind has changed some of my own views. I'm very careful now about jokes that I tell because I think jokes can be needlessly disrespectful. And I actually
as
now
Don
believe,
Imus was telling me just the other day.
And also, I would have defended 10 or 15 years ago the wisdom of the Danish newspapers publishing the cartoons, which were hostile to Islam. I now think that was a very bad idea. It resulted in maiming and in deaths. And more importantly, it was a very disrespectful kind of thing.
But how does that fit into free speech and the ability of cartoonists and others to satirize what they see as excess or wrong?
I think one should be able to say what one thinks, but one should try to say it in as clear and as unnecessarily incendiary way as possible, which particularly in the case of Islam would mean words rather than graphic images. Because in Islam, graphic images of human beings themselves are not often done. And the idea of making fun of prophets or of Muhammad is so deeply vicious that I think free speech and the First Amendment have to take a second place to us living together on a planet. Would I put the leaders of the newspapers in jail? Of course not. Moreover, there's nothing to stop you or me from putting a cartoon on the internet and letting everybody have access to it. So I'm moving more and more to a distinction between what we might call the responsible press, mm-hmm. whether it's written or visual, which censors itself for things which are needlessly incendiary when you can say the same thing in language without being incendiary. So I don't know if I'm right or wrong on this, but it's a rare example of how an author changes his or her mind on the basis of what they've written. And that leads to the fifth mind called the ethical mind. That's a more abstract kind of mind. The ethical mind says, I'm a worker. I'm a journalist, a teacher, whatever. What are my rights and what are my responsibilities in that role? And it says, I'm a citizen of my community. I heard the discussion of SUVs before. Mm-hmm. What are responsibilities to the community, to the country, to the region, and to the wider world? I mean, if I'm emitting gases which contribute to global warming, what's my responsibility? Is that somebody else's responsibility or is that mine? And the very question that you ask, Brian, about free speech and journalists is an example of pitting an ethics versus a respect. You might say the ethics for a cartoonist is to say exactly what he or she thinks and exactly the way they want to think. The respect says, hey, wait a second. Is there a way that you can do this which isn't going to result in maiming and burning of buildings and killing of people?
So the synthesizing mind can weave them together?
Well, at the end of the book, at the end of the five minds, I say the ultimate act of synthesis is a personal synthesis. Because we can't just have these five minds kind of wobbling around like marbles. We have to put them together into a single individual. And often there is tension between the minds. For example, the creating mind is in tension with the respectful mind because most of us have teachers or mentors or bosses who've taught us things, and we owe them a certain amount of respect. But the creative mind overthrows models. Many people from Asia will actually move to the West because in Asia, a place like Japan or Korea, it seemed to be so wrong to contradict your teacher or mentor or master. Mm-hmm. And yet creative activity involves doing just that. And at least in the West, the mentor is not in a position to stifle you or to keep you from getting any kind of a job.
We have two minutes left. Your main interest traditionally has been in education. Are there lessons for parents and teachers in Five Minds for the Future?
Oh, absolutely. One is just to be aware of these minds. Probably everybody is aware of the disciplined mind, but the imperative of synthesizing or the need to distinguish respect from ethics, those are concepts which I've introduced in the book, and I think it's important to think about them, whether or not you agree with them totally. But no, the most important thing is to model the kinds of minds we admire, to try to be disciplined, to synthesize, to create a respectful environment at home and at school and at the workplace, and to be ethical, which doesn't mean doing what's right when it fits into your self-interest, but doing what's right even when it doesn't fit into your self-interest. Positive and negative models are very important. People who work for newspapers like the New York Times had shocks when they heard about Jason Blair, the young reporter who plagiarized and made up things. And this was a wake-up call to people in journalism that you had better supervise your young people well and set a positive kind of model. And obviously parents and loved ones and people in the neighborhood on the street are the most important models when you're young. Then when you go to the workplace, your first boss and your first colleagues have tremendous importance in whether you move down an ethical road or a not-so-ethical road. You've probably talked in this program about the Wall Street Journal. The reason so many journalists are upset by its purchase by Rupert Murdoch is because there's a fear that the newspaper will become more of a money-printing machine and less of one that tells things the way they are, even if they go against the self-interest of the newspaper.
And in our last 30 seconds or so, this book is published by Harvard Business. Are you talking to managers and workers looking to succeed here?
Well, looking to succeed in the long run, absolutely, because in the long run, any business which contains disrespect and is unethical will go out of business quickly, like Enron or Arthur Andersen, or more gradually, as some of the giants of the last 50 years did. But it works against the profits for the next quarter. If all you want to do is have better quarters, better profits next quarter, then you should cheat and be disrespectful and sell your stock when you can. But then we have to raise the question, Brian, which kind of world do you and do your listeners want to be in?
And that is a good rhetorical question on which to leave it. Howard Gardner, professor of cognition and education at Harvard, is now the author of Five Minds for the Future, published by the Harvard Business School Press. One of his previous books was Changing Minds, and we heard an example today of how someone in the public eye actually changes his mind and admits it. Very admirable. Dr. Gardner, thanks a lot.
Always good to talk with you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.